Do you really believe that your religious freedoms are respected? Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Good to have you back, Barry, in the studio. We had a pretty good show last week with Larry Oldacre from the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, the regional home missionary. And just to remind everybody, in the Lancaster area, there is a Bible study on Thursday nights at 7 in the Glass Museum on Main Street in downtown Lancaster. It's a they're studying R.C. Sproul's series. And you're completely welcome if you're interested in finding out more about Reformed theology, about maybe what R.C. Sproul's talking about. Or if you just like R.C. Sproul, come on down, meet some of the other folks who are engaging in that study. And Larry Oldacre will be happy to have you there and be happy to greet you. So again, 7 p.m. Thursday nights for the next, I think, 4 or 5 weeks in the Glass Museum on Main Street in downtown Lancaster.
Well, Chuck, I'm glad you brought that public service announcement up at the beginning of the program, because it actually is part and parcel of what I wanted to talk about today. I'm glad to hear that there's a new work that's getting started in the Lancaster area, and I'm glad to hear they found a location. But as you know, and you and I both know from a lot from personal experience, sometimes your beliefs and your viewpoints exclude you from being able to use certain outlets to speak about those beliefs. I take the example of our Institute on the Constitution classes, where our class at Mount Vernon Nazarene University, we will no longer be teaching up there because there was a complaint, most likely from a faculty member, about how the content of the course material we were teaching. Now, sadly enough, we weren't able to actually sit down with the administration and discuss it and ask them if it ever actually looked at or had sat in on any of the classes, when we were basically said that we would not be welcome back to teach that class on that campus again.
Well, and that's part of the issue, is that Mount Vernon Nazarene University is a Nazarene, you know, the Church of the Nazarene.
Right.
And unfortunately, it has become no longer a Nazarene university. It is a secular university.
Right. And so therein lies the rub, because the more secular that institution is becoming, the less, well, let's just use the term, tolerant they are of religious expressions that are, well, shall we say, exclusive, like Christianity, like biblical Christianity. But we're seeing that more and more all over the fruited plain. I mean, even to the point of our latest class in Westerville, our original place of occupation for that class was going to be a church here locally in this town. But they also were concerned about the appearance to, I guess, church members of the community, of having an organization come in and talk about our founding from a biblical perspective.
Yeah, we've reached the point in this country, both through efforts without and within the church, that let's put it the way it is. It's a Gnostic way of looking at the way church deals with government issues, and that is, government is bad, the church is good. The world is bad, but Christians are all good. Well, no, God created the world, and he said it was good, and he created man and said he was good, and then Adam sinned, and voila, everything was changed in a flash, and the world became corrupted, Adam became corrupted, and they are both corrupt. And how do you uncorrupt them? Well, you only through the work of Jesus Christ. And that's the way we ought to understand this. Only through the work of Jesus Christ, who will eventually remake it all. That's not going to happen through our efforts, but it's going to happen through his efforts. And some of the things that we do under his direction will make it better. It won't make it perfect. Only he can make it perfect.
No, that's entirely true.
And that's the way no one seems to understand it. We've gotten into this dichotomous way of thinking that under the old Gnostic way of looking things, spirit good, physical bad. Well, that doesn't work.
That's really not true.
No.
It's a false concept brought on by errant worldview. But you know what? Even if we take apart or take away the religious misunderstandings.
Yeah.
And lack of charity in many instances, what we're still left with is the fact that as we're called in scripture that we are going to be against the world. Or the world's going to be against us. You know, the world will hate you for my sake, says Christ. But that's what we're seeing more and more. I mean, it shouldn't be surprising. I know it's still distressing for many people of religious faith when they hear about reports about secular sources, whether it be governments or whether it be private actors, basically telling someone of religious faith, you can't hold that belief or speak it publicly or allow it to guide how you conduct your business, how you educate your children, how you decide to share that faith with others. They're saying that that's invalid. In other words, they're not tolerant in their tolerance. And that's an issue that we've dealt with in this country for a long, long time. This isn't anything new. But the vast majority of people, I believe if you probably went out on the street today or went to most churches today, if you did a survey, you would probably find that probably the large majority of people believe that our religious expressions are adequately protected. Now, I beg to differ because knowing I work in these areas, and so do you, that we know as we're paying attention throughout the country and here in Ohio, that those instances sometimes are only protected if an individual or an organization are willing to spend the time, effort, and money to file a federal lawsuit against the offending entity, whether it's a governmental entity or a private actor, to defend their religious freedoms. Now, we know, and our listeners should know, because of many times we've talked about this, that the First Amendment to the United States Constitution clearly states that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. That's that free exercise clause that we're really talking about here. And the vast majority of people think that that means that you're more than happy and fine to, you know, build a church and conduct church services and do outreaches and things of that nature without governmental interference. But that hasn't been the experience.
No, not at all.
It hasn't been the experience since the founding era, but I don't want to go that far back. I want to talk about some things modern. What we've had is a growing animus toward biblical religion, toward Orthodox Christianity. Now, many other faith expressions, such as Buddhism, Hinduism, and even what we would call Mohammedanism or Islam, have gained greater acceptances and greater protections in the public arena. But at the same time, biblical Orthodox Christianity has begun to wither or have withering attacks brought against it in the public arena.
I would say that things like Buddhism, Islam especially lately, even other religious faiths, and let's face it, secular humanism is one and has been named one by the Supreme Court.
Yes.
I believe in a 1960 case. The fact is that they have been given preferential treatment over and above Christianity. And, you know, just to give you a little citation, there was a recent case where a young girl for a Christmas program was asked for a special thing that the family did. And she gave a presentation, or began to give a presentation, on how they put the Christmas star on top of the tree and how it represents the Star of Bethlehem. And the teacher said, stop, sit down, you are not allowed to give this presentation.
Right.
The parents, of course, had an obvious hissy fit when she got home and told him what happened because the child was devastated. She thought she'd done something wrong. The parents go in, make an appointment to see the principal. The principal makes the little girl give the presentation, and the principal says the teacher was absolutely correct in stopping that presentation. Now, all the other little kids were allowed to give their little Hanukkah presentations.
Sure.
Whatever.
Whatever from their religious whatever faith from background their religious and their faith, traditions.
Or even their non-faith, where they just practice the American civic religion of Christmas, where, well, we just give lots of gifts and put up trees and decorations, and none of it means anything.
Well, we'll have another program at some point soon about the whole concept of Christmas.
About next December,
about I think. Well, you know, Chuck, the vast majority of people, probably our listeners included, are not as dialed in on how frequently these type of things actually do happen in our culture. However, that's no excuse.
No, it isn't.
There's a resource that's been put out by the Family Research Council and by the Liberty Institute, which is Kelly Shackelford's nonprofit law firm down in Texas. And it's called Undeniable, the Survey of Hostility to Religion in America. And this is the 2013 edition. Now, they just started this in 2012. Now, it's interesting because what they say here is, and I want to read this, the open letter to the American people that they have here. And it's a little bit of time, but I think we can go through this.
Sure, go ahead.
It says, to our fellow Americans, your most basic rights are being gravely threatened. This threat is coming in the form of a tidal wave of government-driven hostility to religious liberty in America. Such hostility is a tsunami which, if it reaches shore, will sweep away all your other liberties. Now, I think they're right on point with that. Because if we don't have the ability to express our religious beliefs openly and without collusion or opposition or obstruction from government, we're in deep, deep trouble in this
country.
Very
deep, yes.
And they say, why? The Declaration of Independence, the birth certificate of our nation, acknowledged that all our rights, such as the right to a fair trial and to elect our own government, are endowed by a creator. They are therefore unalienable and not to be violated by government. See, they even got that one on point as well, is that our rights don't come from government. They come directly from God. And God has prescribed how we are to interact with him, to worship him, to express our belief in him, in his word, in the Bible. And as believing biblical Christians, it is our primary duty to obey God in this matter. Or as Paul would say, we are to obey God rather than man. When they were charged with going out and not speaking in Jesus' name in the public by the governing authorities at the time, and even by the religious authorities at the time when it came to the Sanhedrin and the council.
Well, which were one and the same at the
time. Exactly.
Sanhedrin was the civil ruling authority, essentially under the auspices of the Tetrarch and the Roman emperor and Roman governor, depending on what part of Palestine they were in.
Exactly. And so they go on here with this letter. It says, for that reason, the founders called free exercise of religion, guaranteed in the First Amendment to the Constitution, our first freedom. Now, remember, the First Amendment was actually drafted by whom, Chuck?
Oh, well, George Mason.
George Mason, my favorite founder. Okay, folks, do a study on George Mason. I think you're going to be very impressed.
Yeah. Mark Levin, notwithstanding, James Madison did not write
the First Amendment
or any of
the Bill of Rights. That's right.
He did edit them.
Yes, he did.
Down from hundreds of proposals that he received, he did edit them, but he did pay the George Mason drafted, and he substantially, the language is exactly what Mason submitted
originally.
Yeah.
That's right. And the letter goes on. They regarded the right of everyday people to express open allegiance to the Creator as a safeguard against government attacks on any rights given by that Creator. But what if open and widespread expression of religious freedom in government, schools, workplaces, the military, public places, and more is eliminated, driven into the shadows of society? What if religion becomes an opinion only to be expressed privately in your home? And we'll talk about how that's not even allowed anymore.
Yeah.
Or quietly in your church, if at all. What if religious liberty becomes a poor, subservient tenant of an arbitrary and imperious government landlord. If that occurs, then government can erase any of your rights as it sees fit, since government, not the creator cited by the founders, will be regarded as the ultimate definer, giver, or taker of all rights. This book shows that such a disastrous reversal, government placed above the religious impulses and liberties of its citizens, is happening now, today. The threat is being pushed by wealthy radical organizations such as the ACLU, the Freedom From Religion Foundation, Americans United for Separation of Church and State, American Atheists, and even misguided government officials who seek to delete religion from the public arena, from schools, and even from churches. The following collection of legal matters detailing anti-religious discrimination throughout America documents this threat. The tidal wave is growing. Indeed, the tide is already rising around our legs. I would say it's up around about our belly buttons these days.
Yeah.
Remember, this was just in 2013.
Right.
Attacks on religion by government are the worst they have ever been in American history. There's still time to turn back this tide. In fact, there is encouraging evidence that we can do so if we choose. And therein lies the rub, Charles. It's the church that is going to have to stand up and speak up on these issues. The same church that you just described earlier,
yes,
saying government bad, church good, so we keep the two separate.
Right. And, what would Jesus do? Well, he certainly wouldn't have anything to do with the government, which is completely false.
Yeah, but, and we can talk a little bit later about the Romans 13 fallacies as
right.
well. Okay, so Liberty Institute and the Family Research Council, going back to the letter here, have joined forces to boldly defend and restore religious liberty in America. This includes opposing and exposing the escalating efforts by activist organizations and government bureaucrats to redefine and regulate religious freedom as conceived by America's founders. From the local district courts to the U.S. Supreme Court to the halls of Congress and state legislatures, we will face each challenge head-on to protect our most precious liberty, our freedom of religion. We offer this book both as an undeniable warning and an encouragement to join us in restoring religious liberty. And that's signed by Kelly Shackelford, who's the president of Liberty Institute, and Tony Perkins, who's the president of Family Research Council. Chuck, just in this 2013 edition alone, they have recorded over 1,200 incidences of hostility to religion in America, from court cases to local government edicts and expressions that have put restrictions, outright bans, fines, punishments, and imprisonment upon individuals for expressing their first freedoms.
And I would posit that that is not anywhere close to a complete list.
Oh, no, because sometimes these cases are settled before they ever go to trial, and so they never, especially at the state levels, never actually get into a LexisNexis database search if you're an attorney and you're looking for these things. And rarely, unless it's something of great egregion that the offended party actually gets a megaphone and starts talking about, do the media ever cover it. So many of these are going quietly in the city council chambers and in the halls of government, where they're passing these edicts and then sending letters to the offending parties, or in some worst cases in our country, SWAT teams into the homes to shut the quote-unquote offenders down.
Well, okay. This is part and parcel. What percentage, let me ask you, what percentage of people who homeschool are doing so because they're Christians?
Well, Chuck, you know, homeschooling is not a exclusively Christian effort.
No.
There are a number of secular and non-Christian belief families who are homeschooling.
Right.
However, the overwhelming majority are of Christian Orthodox beliefs.
And where are we going? We spent basically the 1970s and 1980s digging out of the hole of not being allowed to homeschool.
Right. Actually, before, I believe, 1982, it was not legal to homeschool in this state.
Yeah, in a number of states.
Yes.
And thanks to the efforts of basically of people like R.J. Rushdooney, who went around, made a career for a while of going around and testifying in these cases.
Being an expert witness, that's
now,
right.
You may ask what that has to do with anything. This is part and parcel of a concerted effort to make sure that families no longer have the right to homeschool, to use religion as a basis for You can see that at the federal level with the case against the German family who
yes.
came here for the freedom to homeschool and are now being deported
back to Germany.
Back to Germany,
where they will actually be criminals for allowing their for teaching their own children at home,
and they're treated like criminals here by the United States Justice Department.
We're headed by Eric Holder, now, who himself is probably a criminal. I said it.
Yeah, yeah, he is a criminal. He's a constitutional criminal. And the fact is, we spent the 90s and 2000s, early and the first decade of the 2000s, proving that homeschooling was a superior method.
Yes, and it's still weighing out that that's the case, because that's the reason why so many secular colleges and universities have created special intake mechanisms to attract homeschoolers who may not have the traditional corpus of work that the public school student has when they present a transcript.
And right, and I'm part of that issue. You know, my people find out that my daughters are homeschooled, and they're like, "Oh, we'd really like to have you here."
Yeah, exactly.
Because homeschoolers have a much increased graduation rate. They have a better ability to grasp the material. They have basically a more comprehensive worldview.
Yes, they do, as a matter of fact.
Which is, everybody says, well, they're not socially acclimated, they can't do this, they can't do that. Well, they haven't spent all their life having a certain type of instruction that basically closes their minds and makes them automatons. They've learned how to think for themselves and learn for themselves. Now, what does that have to do with what's going on at hand? Basically, because Christians are so independent-minded, they have to be shut down and taken out of the public square.
Well, yes, and that is probably the underlying philosophical underpinnings of some of these governmental and even non-governmental actors, like these groups that Shackelford and Perkins talked about in their book, some of their motivations for attacking public expressions of Orthodox Christianity. Now, I think it's interesting, Chuck, because we're talking about the country. And we say, well, wait a minute, we have the First Amendment. Well, you know what the problem is, Chuck, is that the rest of the Constitution isn't being followed the way it should be to start with. And what we've had is a series of cases. You even referenced one where secular humanism was deemed to be a religion. But we've had a number of other cases in the United States Supreme Court that have attacked the underpinnings of that first freedom. And one of the most egregious ones. Now, let me back up about 30 years here.
Okay.
Okay. Actually, a little over 20 years. We had, during the 90s, there were attacks upon religious liberties, okay? And so the Congress responded, and in 1993, they passed a little piece of legislation called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Now, the Senate passed it by a 97-3 vote, okay? Now, this is remember, this is 1993, so this is Bill Clinton's administration. The United yeah. States Senate passed it, and the House, and unanimous voice vote in the House. Unanimous, okay? That doesn't mean everybody voted for it. That means that just the ones who spoke up voted.
Everybody said aye. Nobody said no.
Nobody said no. And then Clinton signed this bill into law. And basically, RFRA said that you cannot overly burden. You have to have a compelling governmental interest in order to burden somebody's religious expression to achieve that governmental interest. Well, that's great, right? Fantastic. Well, of course, you know, court cases were going to happen. And so what happened was, the reason why they passed that bill in 1993 was a little court case in 1990 called the Employment Division versus Smith. Now, this was a case, I believe, coming out of Oregon. And basically this case said, okay, we don't have to have compelling interest anymore in order to justify government intrusion into religious practice. All we need is a reasonable standard or a rational standard for the government's actions. In other words, they didn't have to prove a compelling interest. They just had to say, because government thinks we need it, then it's okay to prohibit somebody's expression. Now, a problem, Chuck, and I'll be the first to admit it, that many of these United States Supreme Court cases dealt with Native American religious expressions in the relation of using controlled substances as part of their quote unquote religious worship services.
Yeah.
Like whether it's the ingesting of peyote,
mushrooms, all kinds of stuff.
And there's another one about, I think it's huaca tea, which has a controlled substance that's part of the tea, you know.
It's part of the Vision Quest deal where you go into a sweat lodge and take whatever hallucinogenic.
Right. And again, you know, ladies and gentlemen, we're not sitting here. We're not taking a side on the war on drugs or whether or not government regulation of controlled substances is legitimate or not. Although we can talk about that in a later program.
Yeah.
And I think we have some interesting ideas on those. But we are looking at the fact that the United States Supreme Court basically said that if the government says, no, you can't, you know, if peyote is part of your religious practice, you cannot bring a case if your employer fires you because they're found traces of this substance in your system when you do a drug test. Okay. But what they did, it wasn't so much that decision. What they basically said was, and the court, and this was, you know, in 1990, so the Sandra Day O'Connor was a big part of that drive.
Sure.
Now, and I've got, and it's interesting because I have a quote in here, if I can find it here, from a paper by attorney Christopher Lund, who's a law professor at the University of, or Wayne State University up in Detroit. And he talked about that case, the Smith case, and he talked about the interpretation by Justice O'Connor in this particular case. Now, it's going to take me a moment here to find it, and I apologize. But what they really got down to say is that government had a greater legitimacy in passing any kind of regulatory scheme of any type over somebody's first freedom, over their religious practice. And you can see where that could be abused in relation of, you know, whether or not a church can expand on their own property via zoning issues.
It turns the First Amendment on its head.
Yes, it does.
Because it basically says, no, where the First Amendment is clearly about the government shall have no oversight or control over religious expression, this says, no, the government has a duty to control religious expression through a no longer a compelling interest, but just sort of as a general nib. They have the right to nib, if you will.
Yep. They do. So what happened was the Smith decision got passed in 1990, and it threw religious liberties on their ear. Basically, any governmental action could trump the First Amendment.
Yeah.
Okay. So that, and right there, the court should never have been going down that road because the First Amendment is something they're supposed to be judging the law and the facts by.
Is this a law of unintended consequences?
No, it is. It is indeed. It is indeed. So Congress reacted in 1993, passed RFRA to basically nullify that court decision and say you have to have a compelling governmental interest in order to impinge or burden religion. Okay? Great. Wonderful. However, turning the clock forward again, 1997, another case comes before the United States Supreme Court called the City of Burney, Texas versus Flores. And basically what the court did was they split hairs, split infinitives, if you want. They said, okay, fine. RFRA can apply to federal government actions and federal law, but you can't extend it to the states, period. So in other words, the states were now back under Smith.
Oh, boy.
Okay, which means that what happened from that point forward was that the implication of that decision, and the court actually even said this, is that states should pass their own religious freedom protections. And so that's what started happening, Chuck. And as of this year, 19 states have passed statutory provisions protecting religious and defending religious liberties, religious expression of their citizens, a la the federal RFRA, is what we call RFRA, Religious Freedom Restoration Act, the RFRA. The 19 states have done so, with Kentucky and Hawaii being the latest two to have passed those particular provisions. Now, what we've run up against in Ohio is that Ohio was one of the major states that hadn't passed anything. Well, that's changing because just this last year, at the end of December, a couple of state legislators, Tim Derrickson from Butler County down in the southwestern part of the state, and Bill Patman, who is a Democrat member, African-American Democrat member from Cleveland, got together and they wrote the State Religious Freedom Restoration Act bill. It's House Bill 376, and it's in the legislature right now. Now, the reason why I bring this up is because of what's been happening, not just around the country, but even here specifically in Ohio, where we're showing that this is needed. Because right now, even though our state constitution says that religion is an important fundamental foundation of everything in our state, governmental actors and those acting on behalf of government are under the federal rubric of Smith, because when this other decision came down, Flores' decision, they basically said, no, you can't do that. You can't extend it to the states. Now, there was another case that came a little bit later, and it was called Gonzalez versus, and I can't do Spanish, so forgive me for butchering this, O Centro Espírita Beneficiente Unidad de Vegetal. Okay, so basically this was about a case about some Central American religion expression that was happening, and they were, it was a Brazilian group, and they wanted to import a tea leaf called hoasca. I never can pronounce that right.
And plus, it's Portuguese, so it's not the same. That's in Portuguese.
That's Portuguese, not Spanish.
And
okay,
it's, so it's going to have a completely different pronunciation.
I'm sorry not to be ethically sensitive on this matter, but it contained a substance called dimethyltryptamine, or DMT, which is a Schedule I controlled substance.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, again, some of these religious liberties cases, like I mentioned, are really around Native American and South American Native expressions of their animist or non-Christian religious belief systems. That doesn't make it right for government to bar all religious expression to try to get at another governmental interest, such as controlling the use of what they determine to be a controlled substance. So we're walking. You have to be careful about walking the tightrope on this one, because we're not condoning the recreational or even worshipful use of controlled substances and drugs. But on the other hand, we can't use that as a blanket excuse to say government can override your religious liberties anytime they feel like.
I'm going to say this and open a slight can of worms only to slam it shut again.
Yes.
This is one of the ways in which I've said all along that the war on drugs has produced far more evil than good. And this is one of the places where you run into that the federal government has to have control of every aspect. There's no reason why a state couldn't say, we're going to allow this, but we're going to watch it, just to make sure that it doesn't become a place where people come in and join the religion so they can distribute this stuff.
Right. Now, it's interesting because I mentioned Justice O'Connor. Now, back in the Smith decision, back in 1990, she basically cited with this issue that, okay, I'll concur on this, but I'll hold on to the strict scrutiny model. In other words, the government has to have a compelling interest in order to burden a religion. Now, that's not what the majority found. So her decision was kind of split. She was for it and against it. Now, in the Gonzalez case, she basically, in representing the middle of the court, she accepted, okay, and in Smith, she accepted the government's condition that no religious exemption was possible. This was the Peyote case, the Smith decision. Because Schedule I substances were inherently dangerous, and because allowing any exceptions at all would threaten the regulatory scheme. Well, Gonzalez goes 180 degrees the other direction with that, and she concurred in that one as well. Now, Chief Justice Roberts, who finally got to hear that, because, you know, this was right before she was leaving the bench.
Right.
Roberts called the Gonzalez case, quote, the classic rejoinder of bureaucrats throughout history. Now, he basically said that it basically requires that government asserts interests rather than just uniform laws, and that government prove the compelling nature of those interests with the ordinary tools of litigation. In other words, you can't just say because we want to, you actually have to prove why it's the most reasonable means of carrying out this interest of government, which is kind of what the state RFRAs deal with. However, if you think, why are the states doing all this if this federal case is out there? Because they limited it just like Smith limited it to only federal, and that also that the city of Bernie case, that it can only apply to federal governmental actions, not to state and local. So we still are left with this gaping hole that a state or a locality can basically impinge upon religious freedom any way they feel like. And unless you bring a federal court case under these precedents, you're kind of out of luck. Sorry. Or as Christopher Lund, the law professor, stated it, he said, religious observers will need to win exemptions from all the legal regimes that bind them, from federal laws, from state laws, and from local laws. They must wage battles in every political sphere simultaneously, and they must win each one. If they fail anywhere, they fail completely. Now, that's not a fair level playing ground for those who hold sincerely held religious beliefs. Because you're basically saying is, if you want to practice your religion and a governmental entity comes and basically says no to you, then you have to make it a federal court case, spend all that money, go through all those years of expensive litigation, and if you lose at any level...
You lose.
You lose, period. Not good. That's why House Bill 376 has been introduced. Now, this bill basically says in Ohio that in order for government, a government actor, and that includes any level of government, state or local, that they would basically says that state actions or an action by any person based on state action, which would preclude people like the ACLU and others for suing on behalf of the state when they don't act, shall not burden a person's right to exercise of religion, even if the burden results from a rule of general applicability, like a Schedule I controlled substance rule, unless it's demonstrated that applying the burden to that person's exercise of religion in that particular instance is both of the following. So it's a two-pronged test.
Right.
Number one, essential to furthering a compelling governmental interest. Not just part of compelling it, but it's essential to it. In other words, if we didn't do this, we couldn't get to anything else. And number two, the least restrictive means of furthering that compelling governmental interest. So in other words, it has to be essential and the least restrictive way of going about doing it. Now, we know that there are probably certain instances where that will probably be upheld. So this isn't a panacea or a cure-all for every type of religious expression against government. But what it does do is that it protects the majority of religious expressions from this type of adverse effect by a governmental actor.
Onerous regulation.
Onerous regulation.
Yeah.
Now, again, this wouldn't necessarily cover, in our good friend Judge Jim DeWeese up in Richland County, who put up a plaque of the Ten Commandments in his courtroom, this wouldn't necessarily cover that, because even though he might be an individual, he's also a government actor, and so he was sued by the ACLU under federal law, so he would fall under the decisions of Smith and City of Bernie and Gonzalez in relation to whether federal actors can be bound from their personal religious expression or religious expression by someone who is in a position of governmental authority. That's kind of an entirely different classification. What we're speaking of is a classification of your average citizen. Chuck, you and me.
Yeah.
You know, you and me and the rest of them make three, that kind of thing. So we're not talking about something like that where you have a governmental actor being sued for a potentially personal action that runs a counter to government interest. But what we are talking about is about situations like what happened just about 3 or 4 years ago at Wright State University in Dayton, where Campus Bible Fellowship, which is a Christian group, had a charter to have an organization on that campus at Wright State University. And part of their reason for being, their mission, their organizational statement, their constitution, if you will, Charles,
yeah,
was that in order to be a member or to be an officer, that you had to have an orthodox expression of faith and be willing to swear by the same. Well, of course, the university started threatening them and basically said, you can't do that. You have to be open to anybody coming in, whether they share your belief or not. And that, you know, ended up having to be taken toward litigation, okay? Once the university was threatened with litigation, they backed down. Now, Campus Bible Fellowship had been on Wright State University's campus for 30 years prior to this, okay? They had been operating without being molested for 30 years, but then all of a sudden, somebody comes in there. Well, we just can't have you having this exclusive charter that says that if you're going to have officers or members, they have to express, in Campus Bible Fellowship, they have to believe the Bible, you know? That's part of your organization's reason for being. That's part of your religious belief.
One wonders if there would have been the same requirement of an Islamic association.
Well, I'm sure that there wouldn't have been. But you know what? We have other cases that have happened in that respect as well. As a matter of fact, an individual, if you remember the Crystal Dixon case out of the University of Toledo, this was someone who was a second-level bureaucratic administrator at the University of Toledo who, in her private life, wrote a response letter to some leftist, you know, campus, or not campus paper, but a community newspaper, basically touting the benefits of homosexuality. And she responded back as an African-American woman because they tried to equate homosexual practice
with race.
With ethnicity. Yeah, yeah. Race. Yeah. Or skin color. I don't use race, and you know that.
Sorry about that.
We're all of one blood. It's just that we have different ethnic expressions. And she took offense at that, and so she expressed her personal viewpoint in that community newspaper as a response to that public statement of belief by this other person. Well, what happened was the University of Toledo ultimately fired her because they didn't think that she had the right to express her viewpoint based upon her sincerely held religious belief that homosexuality is a choice and that skin color is not.
Yeah, actually, I don't think she was an administrator. I could be wrong. She was a grad student.
No, she was an administrator. There's another case.
There's another case like this where graduate degrees have been refused on that basis.
Right. Well, there have been. There have been numerous cases. Now, another case in Ohio that I'm intimately familiar with because, well, hey, I was one of the plaintiffs.
that would do it.
Was when our organization, Citizens for Community Values, who I used to work for, we wanted to start doing a series of presentations in communities. We invite pastors, invite people of faith to come and learn more about our Christian history and Christians' involvement in politics, and also give them, you know, understanding of what the rules and regulations are of federal law in relation to pastors and religious leaders speaking up about politics, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, we had reserved a meeting space at a library here in suburban Columbus.
I remember this case.
To do this. And once we reserved it, they said, well, send us kind of a, you know, brief summation of what your event's all about, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so we did. And we specifically spelled out that, you know, as part of this, we were going to be teaching that we're going to have a time of prayer. We were going to have a time of, you know, celebration and of petitioning God for, you know, there to be better actions by government. Well, after they had pre-approved our use of the meeting room, and, you know, we'd submitted a deposit, et cetera, all of a sudden we get a letter back, well, we can't do that. And, you know, we can't let you be here because part of your event has, and I quote, and I think this was hilarious, it says that your event contained, quote, inherent elements of a religious service. And that was impermissible for this public library to allow anything that smacked of a religious service to have access to the public meeting spaces in their library. Now, this is a library that's paid for by taxpayer dollars, Charles. This is not a private library. There's only a handful of those left in the country. We had one out in southeastern part of the county in Franklin County, or actually down in, I think it was down in Licking County, which then went public because they couldn't maintain their foundation.
Yeah, it was the old Collier's Library.
Wagnalls. Wagnalls.
Yeah, Wagnalls.
But this wasn't Wagnalls. Yeah. Okay, this was, okay, I'm going to name it. It was the Upper Arlington Public Library. Well, our organization had to sue them in federal court over this because it was ridiculous. It was an educational outreach to talk to them about the IRS and what the rules were. And also, since pastors and believers, why we pray and we petition God and we have some celebration. But no, that was too much of a religious service for them, and that was impermissible. Now, I suppose that a secularist or an atheistic group could come in there and do whatever they felt like as long as they paid the fees. So we had to push, and the federal courts actually ruled in our favor. And you remember what happened? The response of the library wasn't to say, okay, we were wrong, and yes, religious liberties are protected by the First Amendment, and we're a public venue. What they did was they just shut down the meeting rooms to anybody from the public. And in other words, if we can't keep you from keeping your religious elements out of our library, we just won't let anybody use it. Now, that was probably one of the most inane responses I've ever heard from a governmental body, because remember, a library board of trustees is an elected body.
These are the guys who scream bloody murder if you ask them to take things like a Columbus Alive out from the front that are pushing strip clubs.
Or the gay newspapers, have some very, shall we say, explicit letters and columns in their
advertising
that they're putting out for free at a level where young children can get a hold of.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they don't want that. But basically, so this library basically said that, you know, that we were prohibiting because the library's meeting room policy barred religious services. Right there's a big red flag, Chuck. Now, you know, this case was 5 or 6 years ago. But the point is that why can't a group who has a foundation in biblical Christianity use a public meeting facility like anybody else can? Is there going to be such a impact upon the library board of trustees, the library staff, if somebody in a meeting room is actually sitting there with their head bowed praying?
Well, that all goes back to a misinterpretation of what the First Amendment says and what it means.
Yes, it does.
That goes back no further than 1947.
Right.
And that is that that old separation of church and state thing. And in fact, you sent me over an article, and the one thing that caught my attention in it, this is from the Dayton Daily News, and it's on House Bill
376.
The American Civil Liberties Union of Ohio isn't sure a state law can outdo what's spelled out in the Constitution. Now, let's be clear. What they're claiming is spelled out in the Constitution is not spelled out in the Constitution.
That's correct.
And as we've said, as you mentioned, the ACLU is infamous for coming in and suing people like Judge James DeWeese for putting the Ten Commandments, which is the basis of American law, whether you like it or not, it's the basis of American law, up in his courtroom. And on the basis that what the First Amendment says is separation of church and state.
No, it doesn't.
And of course it doesn't. It says Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or
prohibiting
restricting the free doesn't even say prohibiting. It says restricting the free exercise thereof.
Actually, I think it does say prohibiting. Take a look.
Hold on.
Grab your pocket constitution. I believe it says prohibiting the free exercise thereof.
Okay, hang on. We will read.
And I may be wrong in that.
We will read.
I'm going to be publicly embarrassed, but that's okay.
It's not something to be embarrassed over. And this is one of the reasons why we
go back to
talk document. About these things. All right. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof abridging the freedom of speech or the press.
Exactly.
So
it is prohibiting.
Yes.
So they can't prohibit you from doing this, but that's exactly what governmental entities and actors acting in lieu of government are doing.
So how did that get twisted on its head? Well, it got twisted on its head by a bunch of smart lawyers who were looking for a loophole to restrict the practice or prohibit the practice of religion.
Religion, yeah.
As regards public life. I can't remember the case anymore. Is that Everson?
Everson v. Walls.
Everson v. Walls, yeah.
Okay. And you've also had cases, Stone versus Graham, which said you can't put the Ten Commandments up in a public school classroom because, the students might look upon them and venerate them and actually follow them.
Like, yes.
Thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not covet, thou shalt not steal, you know.
So basically what we've got is the ACLU, which has made a lot of money.
Yeah, they've made book on this one. That's
yes,
right.
You bet. That's been a very lucrative thing for them to go around on the basis of a false interpretation of the United States Constitution, First Amendment, and sue people until they basically give in and pay a large settlement fee and agree not to do it anymore.
Right.
So the ACLU, and then that cudgel has been picked up by groups like Freedom From Religion Foundation.
Now let's not forget about ones that we've talked about before here as well, military expressions of religious liberty as well, because there's the Military Religious Freedom Foundation, which is to free the military from expressions of religion.
Mikey Weinstein.
That's right. Who has publicly come out and said, hey, I go to the White House and this is going to happen whether you like it or not.
Yeah, basically I have the ear of the President of the United States who we're going to make sure that this doesn't happen.
Right. Well, and even if we discount those instances, because, military personnel come under the rubric of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and so it's up to the Department of Defense in order to set those rules. That's what this the resolution that you and I were looking at and I testified about in committee at the end of last year would call on the DOD to implement the rules protecting military religious liberties. That still hasn't passed the House yet because some members of the chamber in the Democrat caucus are saying they're confused, they're not sure we should be doing this, etc. Now, some of those same members are on the House Judiciary Committee, who is hearing today, we're recording this on Wednesday before Saturday, this afternoon, the proponent testimony, which, yes, I'm going to be testifying in support of House Bill 376. Some of those same members said on the Judiciary Committee, I'm wondering what kind of questions they're going to start asking if they can't even see their way clear of saying, yeah, we should just ask the Department of Defense to put in place something that they've been commanded to by federal law to do. Because the National Defense Authorization Act, the reauthorization, specifically spelled out that military religious freedoms are to be protected. But the DOD won't even pass the rules in order to allow them to know how they can operate. That's a problem at the federal level that I think is going to get worked out, hopefully. At the state level, now the big issue, and I told you we were going to come back around to this, is the fact that it's not just public expression, whether you can stand on a street corner with a Bible and a sandwich board, or whether you can rent a room at a public library to conduct a meeting that has, quote, inherent elements of a religious service. It's whether or not in the privacy of your own home you can invite a handful of people over to study God's Word. Because, honestly, Charles, that is where the big
issue is.
That's
where the rubber meets the road.
That's where the rubber meets the road. Now, let me give you some examples of where the rubber has been burnt on the road. Okay, you have the city of Venice, Florida. Okay? The Rossinger family had a small handful of folks over there. It never got to be more than 10 people at their home. They were fined $250 per meeting by the city because it was impermissible for them to have a Bible study. Okay? What about in California? The Fromm family, they ended up with a $300 fine and were told by the local government that because you had 8 or 10 people over to your house for a Bible study, you have to have a conditional use permit and we won't give you one. But we will fine you for every time the Bible study meets there. Now, Charles, we don't know for sure in those local instances whether or not they allowed other things to take place like tailgate parties or Tupperware parties or ethical culture meetings or the local chapters of American Atheist or of the Unitarian Universalist Church to come together for their religious viewpoints in somebody's private home.
Super Bowl party.
Super Bowl parties, whatever have you. Backyard barbecues, whatever. But we do know in Phoenix, Arizona, that a family, and I've got the information right here, this happened in middle of 2012, but it's still ongoing, that the Salmon family in Phoenix, Arizona, who Mr. Salmon is an ordained pastor, and they were hosting Bible studies on their 4.6-acre property. Now, think about it. Now, keep that in mind, okay, since 2005. But the city of Phoenix basically, in 2009, sent a swarm of a dozen police officers and city inspectors and raided their home, held the family in a room and would not let them move about freely while they looked for evidence that they were doing something that wasn't allowed by city statutes. And basically the city's chief assistant prosecutor said, well, it came down to zoning and proper permitting. Now, Charles, okay, pastor, was he having a full church service at his home? Were they having like 40, 50 cars out there on their 4.6 acres? No. It never got to be more than 20 people at any one time. And one of the times that they were threatened was when they were having a backyard cookout for their Bible study group, and the fire department came out and harassed them and told them they were going to call the police if they didn't break up their 20-person backyard barbecue on their 4.6-acre property. Okay, now this is ridiculous. Now, the city of Phoenix court found him guilty of 67 code violations for allowing people to come over to do a Bible study at his house. He was sentenced to 60 days in jail and fined $12,180 for hosting a Bible study at his home on his 4.6-acre property. Now, Charles, I can see one thing if you're talking about a small apartment room in a complex in a major urban area and you have 15 to 20 people coming in there all the time and each one of them brings a separate vehicle to park in the neighborhood.
Sure, that's a problem.
That can be a problem. But this is ridiculous. And honestly, it is these type of issues that are creating the bigger problem. Now, do we have these happening in Ohio? Of course we are.
Sure we do.
We just don't have as many
we're not hearing
instances
it.
Where we're hearing about it. But basically, so Salomon contacted an attorney, and they have basically gone and said, listen, you know, we're private gathering. These are people gathering on my private property. Well, you know, Salomon decided to one-up them a little bit. He, you know, in 2009, after this, he went and got a city building permit and built a 2,000 square foot building on his 4.6 acre property to have people come over and have their Bible studies and have their fellowship. Was he building a church on his property? Maybe, maybe not. Did he apply for it as a church? No, he applied for it as a building. Now, Chuck, if I build a building on my property and I build a 2,000 square foot building, if I wanted to have people over for a barbecue, for a lecture on Institute on the Constitution, or if I wanted to open God's Word and say, now let's look at the chapter 22 of Revelation and how it applies today. Why should government have any impact on me if I've done the basics, which is the building permit, and I have space, and you know my property, I have space.
Yeah.
I can park 60 people on my property if I wanted to. But basically, you know, they're charging him with all these various things. You know, okay, we're going to say it's a commercial building and you got to have all these things if you're going to have anybody over. I'm sure they're not doing that to neighbors who have parties and gatherings and social events. Why are they singling out Salomon, and why are so many of these families in these states being singled out? It's because of the content of their expression.
Exactly.
It's because of the fact that they're holding to biblical
now,
truth.
See, that's not even a particularly big building.
2,000 square foot is not a very big building.
It's 45 by 45.
Right,
I mean,
exactly.
Yeah,
and I have a friend of mine who lives over in the Hilliard area who has a building smaller than that. As a matter of fact, it's just a very, very big garage, and they have Bible studies there all the time.
I've been in that building, and
yes, you could
easily get 20 people in there because we've done it.
Yeah, we've done it before. That's right. But, you know, that's the whole point. And now, so you, like you mentioned about this article in the Dayton Daily on House Bill 376, the ACLU, well, we can't, sure, a state law can undo what's spelled out in the Constitution. Well, when you have in the Gonzalez case, they're begging states to pass their own RFRAs and saying that the federal government cannot pass a law that would direct the states and how they operate in this area.
It's called the 10th Amendment.
It's called the 10th Amendment,
yes.
Ladies and gentlemen. So guess what, ACLU? You need to go back and do your legal homework.
Well, Barry, this is exactly why we teach people in our Constitution class that you cannot allow the federal government to be the final arbiter of its own power. You can't, because every time you do, they step in and say, well, gosh, we're the supreme entity here, so we decide whether we have this authority or not. No, that's what the 10th Amendment is about. This is what's wrong with all the people out there that are saying things like nullification is bad.
Well, Chuck, that's a good point. Now, what I want our listeners to do is help us out. Go to our website at principledpolicy.com. Click on our links that will show you the contact information for the Ohio General Assembly. Now, this is call your state legislator. And call other state legislators. This is in the House Judiciary Committee. So if you click on that link, you'll find the Columbus area phone numbers for the members of the House Judiciary Committee. But call your own state legislators as well, because they'll be voting on this should it come out of committee into the floor. And we have every expectation that, you know, reasonable heads will prevail and we will pass this piece of legislation. Again, testimony is undergoing, and it's probably going to be at least another 2 weeks before the bill's voted out of committee. So we would ask our listeners and others to call up on House Bill 376 and support protecting our religious freedoms in Ohio. Because sooner or later, it'll be your small group study, it'll be your cell group, it'll be your Bible study, or it'll be your gathering of the youth group at your house that will come under government scrutiny and say it's impermissible for you to do that because of your Christian beliefs.
If you're trying to build a church and you're somewhere in the Franklin County or some other a little more densely populated area, guess what, folks? You're already running into it with zoning, planning, all that nonsense. Don't kid yourself. You are being restricted on what it is they would like to have you be able to do.
Oh, certainly. Absolutely. So Chuck, there's a lot going on. The legislature isn't silent during a year when they're probably focused more on running for election and reelection than on governing specifically. But at least in this instance, we have, and this is a bipartisan bill. There's 45 co-sponsors, both Democrats and Republicans, sponsoring this bill. You know, Chuck, it's great to see people of faith from both sides of the aisle coming together and saying, this is something we need to make a priority.
That's
in the
right.
State of Ohio.
This has bipartisan support. That being said, we're out of time for this week. Join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.